This is IT Visionaries, your number one source for actionable insights and exclusive interviews with CIOs, CTOs, and CISOs, and many more. I'm your host, Albert Chow, a former CIO, former sales VP, and now podcast host. Discover Zayo's expansive network maps on their website and see where their network can take you. With low latency, reliable 400 gig and 800 gig enabled routes, it's the modern network solution you've been searching for. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of IT Visionaries, and across from me is Kit Colbert. Listen, you probably remember him from last time, but if you don't, he's here today. Kit, before we get going, I want to talk to you about modern applications. I want to talk to you about network. I want to talk about all the things that VMware is doing. But before we do that, just in case, if someone's new to the game, let's say you graduated college and you're not familiar with VMware or something like that, what is VMware? What do you guys do? And why would I ask you so much about modern application development?
It's a good question. Well, thanks for having me. Happy to be back. Love to dive into all these topics. So, of course, everyone knows VMware for our vSphere offering and, you know, the virtualization that we did on-prem. You know, we still do that, of course, but we do so much more in the subsequent 20-plus years that we've been around. And really what we're about now is a kind of a multi-cloud modern application company. That's what we're really focused on, this notion of helping customers to deal with using multiple public clouds in addition to what they have on-prem and at the edge. And then helping them to both build new applications as well as modernize their existing ones. So there's a whole bunch of cool tech that spans, that runs the gamut from infrastructure to security to networking to application platforms to end user computing and goes and goes. So we can talk a lot about all those things.
Yeah. And this is why you are the perfect guest to be on the show, because we read and we've done research and, you know, we've read surveys, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners know about this, about how, you know, enterprises have always had a lot of software subscriptions and custom software builds. But this is relatively new. The idea of, first of all, cloud's young to begin with, but then multi-cloud is even younger. And what you're seeing is what you just iterated is all these companies are now trying to take advantage of the best service. They are not as concerned where data is stored, although they do want to move data closer to the compute. But now data, like any single application, is actually a stitch. I don't even know if stitch is the right word, but it's interconnected of multiple services possibly. And so tell me what that means for the developer. Tell me what that means for you guys delivering the service, because this is done obviously in virtual machines, it's done in cloud, it's done on prem, it's happening all the time.
Yep.
Where one software might be pinging who knows how many services just so I can, you know, get a notification. I don't know. I'm trying to. Yep.
So let's take a step back, right?
Yeah.
I think you're hitting on sort of a large shift that we've seen in the industry. And there's a whole bunch of different aspects to it. So traditionally, you had your data center, you had all your apps there, you had all your data there. And so there's this whole model of like everything happens within the data center. And yeah, there's outbound connections, you know, people can connect to it remotely and stuff. But by and large, you think about the network connectivity, you think about security, you kind of like, you know, harden the perimeter around that data center, basically create a big moat and kind of protect it. Everything outside the data center was untrusted. Everything inside the data center was highly trusted, highly interconnected, you know, lots of networking, so forth. And you developed all your apps internally there as well. Now, what we've seen as customers have adopted public clouds is a few things. They started trying to do just one cloud, right? That was the whole idea of hybrid cloud. I'm going to have my public cloud, my one public cloud. I'm going to do my on-prem stuff. I'm going to connect them. And, you know, I've got my, again, my castle in the data center, well protected by its moat. And then I've got stuff in the public cloud, and I'll secure that. I'll connect them. And you kind of have this point-to-point relationship. And that was this, you know, really nice theory that unfortunately didn't really pan out in practice. And the reason is because although customers and businesses tried their best to standardize on a single public cloud, due to many different reasons, they started using more than one cloud. Mm-hmm. And that could be because they're doing acquisitions that use that have standardized on a different cloud. It could be that a line of business decided they want to go use a different cloud for some reason, maybe, you know, better technology for their use case. Or it could be that it's been a few years and clouds have changed and another cloud may be a bit further ahead now in a certain area of technology. So the point being that we see most customers now have multiple public clouds. And to your point, applications are sort of strewn all over those things. You got apps, you got data, you got to connect them up, you got to figure out how to secure them. So this notion that you have this like single place where everything resides and you can like, you know, kind of make the walls really big and protected around it just doesn't exist anymore. What you have instead is a much different architecture. That's something that's highly distributed with stuff sort of everywhere. And there is no real perimeter anymore, at least not a single perimeter. Instead, you've got many, many perimeters. And so that's the situation that I think many companies find themselves in now.
So when you see that, right, and that's, you know, this is like, I don't want to call it Pandora's box, but I don't see it going back. There's no going back. Going to be a place in time in the future where one company is creating all the best services, all the best everything. And everyone just goes, we're all in on this one company. It's just not going to happen anymore. Like that's never going to happen again. So how does that influence like what your team and what you're pushing your engineers to build to help service this? Because the other thing that's not going back is our appetite for speed and responsiveness. Like no customer is like, you can slow it down.
Totally. And I think, you know, it's funny because on that last point, this notion of speed and, you know, in particular for cloud, this notion of self-service that a developer can go just get access to a VM or a resource or whatever they need to get the job done. They don't need to talk to anyone. They can just go get it. It creates a little bit of this complexity and chaos, right? So the question is, and to your point, you're absolutely right. I don't ever see this going back to the quote unquote good old days, but maybe they weren't that good. I don't know. But to the old days, in any case.
Yeah, I just don't see it happening.
So what's interesting about it is that I don't think most folks in the industry, vendors or businesses, people using this stuff, really realized that we'd end up in this multi-cloud state that we're in. Again, the thesis originally was that I'm going to standardize on a public cloud. I'm going to have my on-prem stuff. I'm going to connect those two. That's hybrid cloud, you know, point to point, very simple. Great. And so you look at what happened and the way that we implemented a lot of functionality doesn't really work well in this multi-cloud era. So let me explain that. So if I go and standardize on a public cloud, I can't usually just use it right by itself, right? I need to put some structure around it. I need to put some governance around it. Access controls, for instance. I don't want my developers, for instance, managing the account credentials. I want that to be in some system that can handle it securely, rotate keys, everything, right? I want to do things like, you know, security. To secure it, I want to have a disaster recovery plan, so on and so forth. So when you look at that list of stuff, you know, maybe like build tools, CI/CD pipelines. So you look at that list of stuff. What people did was they specialized it to that particular cloud. So if you went in and said, I'm going to standardize on AWS, you either use the AWS services or you built out a bunch of your own stuff, but that was customized and specific to AWS. And that's fine if you're using just one, you know, one cloud. The problem is once they, again, started using a second cloud, they say, oh crap, well, all the stuff I just did for that first cloud doesn't work here. And they're like, well, since, you know, they looked at it as a one-off, they're like, okay, let me just re-implement a lot of this stuff on that second cloud. So I'm going to redo how I do security. I'm going to redo how I do CI/CD pipelines. I'm going to redo how I do access control. And then for the third cloud, here we go again. They got to redo it. And so what you see is they sort of stamp out these things individually. And of course, they have a whole other solution for how they do things in their on-prem private cloud. So you get this scenario where you've got all this sort of duplication, siloing, inconsistency across all these implementations. And in my view as a technologist is, you know, our problem, what was our problem there? Our problem there is really one of architecture where the services that we were building were specific to a single cloud. You might call them single cloud services. And I think the big shift that we're trying to drive in the industry is an architectural change away from just having single cloud services to having what we call cross cloud services. And the big shift here is that this service can implement functionality or capability once and have it apply and work consistently across anywhere where an application might run or where a person wants to put data. And so, you know, again, think about it from a security standpoint. You say, hey, I want to make sure that I can do incident response properly. So you implement that functionality and you want to be able to do that on AWS or Azure or on-prem or Google or at the edge. You want to do that all very consistently, having consistent sets of data coming back and so forth. So that's really the big industry shift. And I think, you know, to answer your question, how do we deal with this, given that this is a reality that's not going away, is to shift the architecture, is to go at it from the beginning with its design for cross cloud, so that even if a business who maybe is just starting to get into cloud, and again, they're going through the same thing, I'm going to start with one cloud. It's like, okay, you do that, but make sure you adopt a cross cloud architecture for those services from the beginning, just to give you that sort of optionality and flexibility should there come a time where you're going to use more than one cloud.
And then when you think about this change in architectures, where is that going to be? I mean, it sounds like a combination of a couple of things. It sounds like some type of dynamic software systems that can recognize the ports and the gateways that need to be open to handle whichever data points and clouds that need to be there. It has to recognize it like almost on its own, because when I was in software dev and software services, it was just in 2017. So, I mean, six years.
Not too long ago.
But 6 years is a lifetime in software.
That is true. That's true.
6 years is a lot. But at the time, when it was just when people were just starting to say, like, hey, listen, let's say I have all my data in storage in S3, and I want to be able to take advantage of, a TensorFlow model in GCP. But in order to connect these data points securely, there's no like direct line. I have to move it through the public internet. I have to open these like different port services. Like Google has a port service, AWS has a port service. And then you needed an engineer who actually knew how to do it. And that was the like almost the holdup. Like you talked about, hey, people want to spin up and spin down instances in a second. In that gateway, they want to be able to probably do that too. Right. And so you have to almost build like, it would be like universal piping. That's what, how I describe it to people who are not tech familiars. Like it's imagine like if you went to pipe, you were to do any type of plumbing, but no matter what pipe you went to the hardware store, it could just adjust to whatever you needed. That's effectively what software people are trying to create.
What you find is that there are going to be different types of these multi-cloud or cross-cloud services. I kind of use the two terms a little bit interchangeably. Yeah. And so, you know, you're getting at a specific example where you might want a networking cross-cloud service, i.e. to do some level of connectivity consistently. And what you could see there is a couple of things. So what that service might do is if you've got two applications or two components of an app that are within the same cloud, it would not need to do any new functionality per se. Instead, what it can do is just manage the underlying cloud. Like for instance, on AWS, you just manage the VPCs, make sure they're connected and so forth, right? And you can set that from a policy perspective. But then if you're connecting across clouds, okay, well, there you're going to need some new functionality to figure out how to do that and do that maybe in the most intelligent way and try to reduce egress charges and, you know, all these other sorts of things, right? You know, we're doing some really interesting stuff with colo providers like Equinix, because they sit very close to a lot of these public clouds. And so they might have a data center in a certain location that's proximate both to maybe AWS and to Google. So that you can then leverage that as your intermediary between the two, and having the right sort of cross-cloud service could help to orchestrate that for you. So, you know, networking is one of those things. You know, there's management aspects. There's a whole bunch of different ones, but essentially, you know, the way we see it is there's going to be sort of this decomposition of functionality, and you're going to have these different sort of categories of services. And ideally, we could create an overall architecture where there's high degrees of interoperability and compatibility, kind of clean APIs between each of these, so that you get a little bit of modularity, so that, you know, you're not kind of locked into any single vendor, but instead you get some choice in terms of how you bring the best, you know, networking cross-cloud service and management cross-cloud service and security cross-cloud service together, but in a way that they're going to work.
You used a key word just a second ago, which I remember in, you know, like I said, just 6-7 years ago, where they talked about like there were going to be more orchestration tools emerging. And it was like a new category, which is like there's going to be tools to manage tools. And it sounded like, wow, that sounds terrible. but it's necessary because, like you said, people want to build applications. They don't want to figure out how to put these pieces together. They want to build applications that serve customers. They don't want to. I don't want to connect this stuff up. And when you think about that levels of orchestrate, is that how like you're guiding your teams to think? Is like, hey, the first thing I want you to think about, let's imagine I work for you and I have this great idea. I want to say, hey, I have this new service. I think it'll be killer. It's going to be great for everybody. What are like some fundamental principles you're like pushing all your top engineers, product managers, like, hey, you guys got to think this way. It sounds like this like orchestration piece is part of it. Give us an idea of how VMware and your team is thinking about building services and applications to help the next wave of modern application development.
A couple of things. So as I said, you know, we are trying to get that overall architecture and sort of the modularity aspect figured out. And so then the question is, okay, what sort of service is this and how does that fit into that? But then for the specific service, one of the things that we're really working on is how do we, as quickly as possible, get some basic version, some, you know, initial implementation of the service out to the end users. So one of the things we're working on is, so we have this thing that we call Flings, which is basically a way of like us delivering software, pre-release software out to users to get feedback, right?
Okay.
It's a piece of software. You have to install it and manage it yourself. So we want to do the same thing, but for services, right? To deliver a cloud service in that same way. So what we're really trying to do is get out there, get some early users and get that immediate feedback. And that, you know, that, and then be able to cycle very quickly on that feedback to improve the service and make sure that there's real product market fit there. So for me, that's actually the first thing that I push the engineers and the teams on is like, make sure to validate product market fit as early as possible, right? Because oftentimes what you find is you're actually a little bit wrong about how you think you want to solve this and what you think is best for the customer. But the best way to validate that is actually get it out there and get someone really using it, right? So that's, you know, and what you're going to see is us sort of building out that overall architecture with more and more of these sort of cross-cloud services.
I'm curious for yourself, what do you see in the next 5-10 years? How do you see VMware transforming? Because you talked about like, hey, listen, we're most known for this. That was 20 years ago. But it's becoming like, the way I described it so recently is like, it's more like an enterprise toolkit. Like I don't like it's right, more like a, right. It's like a huge array of tools that can help you build wherever you need to build. Like
I think we're getting much more into the application space just in general.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at vSphere and what we did from an infrastructure perspective, we supported applications, but we didn't really get inside, quote unquote, the application. And I think where we're going now is getting that much deeper. What we're doing with Tanzu in terms of a number of things, right? Developer experience, secure software supply chain. There's a whole Kubernetes operational aspect to it as well. But you know, to kind of zoom out a little bit, so where are we going overall as a company? It is kind of a 5-10 year journey about how do we enable this sort of multi-cloud architecture? And what does that look like? And we think we have an opportunity to be sort of the center of that, kind of the foundational building block, which supports sort of this platform and framework interoperability of all these different components. And so we see this as a pretty massive an industry shift that's happening, and we really want to be at the center of it.
Yeah. The we read one of your later or more recent press releases. It was about what happened at Mobile World Congress, where VMware announced it was going to enter the, or I guess you've always been there, but expand SD-WAN clients. So for anyone listening who's not as familiar, software-defined wide area networking is the SD-WAN is the acronym. And you know, I'll do a disservice, but Kit, go ahead real quickly, describe it, and then why are you getting into the space?
Sure. Yeah, so there's, you know, there's a bunch of different pieces about it. So, you know, I think about SD-WAN, the most basic piece is there's a connectivity piece. So traditionally, if you had a remote office, a branch office, a retail store, you know, whatever it is, you need to pay the telcos for a premium, you know, enterprise grade connection, you know, a T1 and up, right? And these things can be quite expensive.
Yep.
And so obviously, you know, now you have the proliferation of consumer grade broadband out there, which is much cheaper and oftentimes, you know, just as fast. The problem though is it's quite unreliable, not to mention there's potential security issues there and so forth. So, you know, what SD-WAN really does is it sits like it's like a physical box, right? That sits on the site wherever you are and connects out into these, there could be consumer, enterprise, whatever you want, but usually people do broadband type things. And essentially, and it connects up to the cloud and then connects you wherever you need to go. But essentially what it does is it is able to leverage sometimes multiple broadband connections to do high availability across them. It's able to combine them to get greater performance. There's a whole bunch of manageability aspects there as well about how you can route traffic intelligently, right? You don't, if you know you're going out to Microsoft 365, you don't want to hairpin that through the data center. You want to go straight out to the internet, right? So you can sort of cordon off network traffic to do the right thing, go in the right way, be very efficient and get to where it needs to go. And then the third piece is really mentioned earlier around security.
Yeah.
Really tightening down this space and you know, ensuring that you can have high degrees of trust of the different devices and apps coming in, and that we also make sure to shuttle all that data securely to where it needs to go. So that's really the idea with SD-WAN. And as I mentioned, historically, it has been a physical appliance. Now, we do offer a virtual appliance as well. We've offered that for a while. So you could, if you have a just a regular, you know, server, you can run a VM with SD-WAN, NSX SD-WAN on it. But the news that you're referring to is actually, you know, a software client that can run on the desktop as well. We now offer a client or a software client for, you know, a personal device and a desktop computer. And, you know, the idea there is that we want to give all the same great functionality, but enable it to be mobile. So wherever that computer happens, especially if it's a laptop, you're traveling around. You're not going to lug this other, you know, physical appliance device. And you probably don't have, you know, the capacity to run like a virtual machine. So let's just do something simple, right? And that's really the thinking behind that.
Visit Zayo's website today to unlock the power of your network and tap into the technologies of tomorrow. Go to zayo.com/network now. How many years behind do you think the industry is? Because we obviously had the 2020 to 2022, huge digital transformation. Many companies were forced to change the way they operated very quickly, of course, allowing remote work. But I still heard, we still had guests that were talking about, hey, there's still a lot of companies that are trying to hairpin back all their traffic back to that physical box that's at their corporate location so that it makes it seem like all the remote workers are now working inside that building and then they can get access to their resources. It's like a very antiquated, it says antiquated. It's like 3 years old. You know what I mean? 3 years old.
Things move fast.
Yeah, things move fast. Yeah. How many companies, because this is an interesting seat that you have. Have all companies completely shifted, or are they like demanding to SD-WAN?
It's a process. Yeah. I mean, to your point, we do see a lot of that sort of hairpinning. And the reason they do that, by the way, again, if you go back to the old model, there was no real security at that edge location, at that retail store.
Yeah.
Instead, that the T1 or whatever it was brought everything, or the MPLS, I guess is the better. T1's a very antiquated. Anyway, the MPLS link went straight into the data center. And that way they could then, IT and security could then apply all of the security checks and so forth. And so this, you know, what they're trying to do is sort of make work this old model, this notion of the data center as the castle that you got to protect, right? And that everything inside is highly trusted, everything outside is not. They're trying to amend that a little bit by saying, well, this remote location is actually kind of part of the data center. That's how we connected in. So network wise, it kind of looks like quote unquote, it's part of the data center. And that way everything that's exiting the data center will still go through all the same security checks and we do all that stuff and blah, blah, blah. Right. But that approach fails to fully acknowledge is that the world we're living in is just very different.
Yeah.
And so this architecture shift here that we're talking about is what they generally call zero trust. And so the zero trust mindset is saying, okay, we're not in this old world of everything's in one data center and it's you protect it from everything outside. Instead, you got this highly distributed world. And so what you have to do is you have to actually implement security at all these different locations. So you got to do it, still at the data center, but you also have to do it at the retail location.
Yeah.
And that way, you don't trust, the connection between them or whatever, but you validate everything. And as it comes out, you can then make, secure connections to, other secure areas like in the data center or maybe a different edge location. So what it is it's sort of driving in a distributed fashion a lot of these things that used to be centralized. And I think that's the really big shift that we're seeing with SD-WAN is it's a very different management model or maybe I should say architecture. And we can enable that management model at a very high scale sense. And so I think companies are starting to see it because there's just so many challenges with the old way of doing things. There are security challenges, there's management challenges, there's performance challenges. The list goes on and on. But if you really kind of opened up your mind to it, you can say, hey, we can really think about things completely differently and adopt this net new architecture. So it's happening, right? And we do see a lot of interest from customers for SD-WAN and really this broader zero trust architecture. But it's, again, one of those things that takes time just because there's so many other conflicting priorities and things to do. And sometimes people just don't really know about it or understand it. So, I think it's one of those things that'll take time to work itself out, but there is clearly a direction to the industry going toward that zero trust architecture.
So that's the next question is, you know, that the original thought process was, well, it's, we could secure it, right? I can, everything in this, everything in this building is secured. Everything outside the building is insecure. You mentioned that. Now we know that data is now moving, like you said, peer to data center, peer to peer, and across every single computer is its own endpoint. Who knows who's, you know, you want to be able to track it all.
Yep.
And also secure it all. And so you mentioned zero trust. Where do you see data security, network security, device security, appliance, whatever you want to call it? Where will VM roles play in that? Because that is pretty fascinating. Because that demand's also not going away.
It's not. And it, you know, really requires some deep integration across these different areas. You know, the notion again of zero trust is instead of having this like single sort of circle of trust, that's your data center, right? This kind of big thing that you stuff a lot of stuff into. You're kind of like shrinking that circle down, and you have a lot of them, right? Yeah, you still have one in the data center, but maybe you have multiple circles in that data center now, and you got one around that office. And maybe with the software client we have here, you got a tiny little circle around your laptop, right? Or your phone. And so, you know, how do these devices play in? Well, here's the interesting thing. When you start getting into these sort of mobile device management capabilities, you can then understand what we call posture. You know, how's that phone or device configured? Is it within our parameters that we set? Also, you can, you know, get location information. Where is this thing coming from? How did this person log in? What sort of authentication do they use? Are they authenticated? So you can use all these different data points to inform the level of access you want to give that device. So for instance, if you see someone that usually is based in the US and you know, connecting from there and logging in a certain way, and all of a sudden the device is in a different country, or maybe like got carted off to Russia or something, you say, okay, that looks a little suspicious. Like, what's going on there? I didn't, you know, we have no data showing that that person was supposed to be traveling there, blah, blah, blah. Maybe the device has been compromised. Maybe it's been stolen. So you can then sort of shut down access. So, you know, we have a really strong portfolio of capabilities. We call them our anywhere workspace capabilities that provide that sort of identity, user identity, device, et cetera, management. And that plugs in to the SD-WAN framework and to what we're doing with network virtualization and NSX as well. And the reason for that is because we can use that sort of posture and essentially risk information to then inform what sort of policies we have and access that we give to a user with those devices. So as I said, you know, when you look and think about zero trust, it really is a lot of different disciplines coming together in order to make that a reality.
Yeah. The and then when I hear you talk about this, my next question starts thinking more towards a large majority of our audience. So a large majority of our audience, as I mentioned before, is in this like zero to 500 employees kind of world.
Yep.
A lot of them are software led. Some are hardware based and they make physical things, but most of them are technology first, software products. And so they're building their companies and they're expanding. At what point do you think in general companies start knocking on VMware's door and they're like, wait a second, we're kind of growing. We need to do things we can no longer do. Because I remember being in the software company where we were like, and again, I'm aging myself, but you know, we were just in a single cloud. It wasn't really a problem. Mm-hmm. We were only in one zone. Like, you know, like that's like forbid. That's like, that's
we were a like, big oh. problem.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I remember we landed a customer, Singapore Air, and they're like, your software is ungodly slow. And we're like, what do you mean? Singapore Airlines, like, this is terrible. Like, we can't use
they're
it.
They're accessing it from Singapore and it's in the US or something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I was like, how long does it take for the image to load? You know? they're only saying it's like, you know, we all know this in engineering is like a couple seconds. You might as well just say the thing doesn't work. Like, people don't want to wait a couple seconds. When do you see companies coming forward and like, hey man, I need to virtualize some stuff. I need to expand some stuff. I can't be everywhere.
It really varies, you know. So, you know, we have multiple lines of business, right? And so the infrastructure side, you see many different types there, right? We do have people, you know, you look at companies that may have store locations and need infrastructure at the store, and there's something they'll come and talk to us about. But, you know, you look at app development, and there's a bunch of cool technology that we've got there. And that's something that, again, pretty early on, we see customers coming in asking for help with. Things like, you know, device management. what we do with Anywhere Workspace. That's another one. So, you know, we see people coming in from numerous different reasons. You know, another one I'm pretty excited about is a relatively new product of ours, VMware Ransomware Recovery.
Oh.
So this is one that's another, like, this is another really cool example of how we're pulling together a bunch of different pieces of our capabilities to make a holistic solution. So what you see out there is a lot of vendors doing ransomware recovery through a backup technology, basically taking periodic snapshots of the files. And then when, if that thing gets broken into and, you know, it gets encrypted for ransomware, well, you can just go back through the backups and find the one before the encryption happened and, you know, you're good to go, right? It turns out you're not, actually, because whatever ransomware malware was on that device is still there. You know, it hasn't been activated yet, but if you turn that older image back on, soon enough it will be. So you got to do a whole bunch of work to get that stuff out of there. And that's really where we see a lot of the challenge with ransomware recovery. And so what we do is this really interesting approach where we use our VMware Cloud Disaster Recovery, which does, you know, backups, right? Replication up to the cloud and take snapshots. And so when an encryption occurs and you need to try to undo that, you can use our tools to sort of understand, okay, when did that occur? Let me find a backup that was before that. And then what we do is we actually launch that. We install our Carbon Black agent, which is doing endpoint security. We launched a copy of the VM in a constrained, controlled environment in VMware Cloud on AWS. And so that is now running, but it can't talk to the network. You know, we lock it down. And that allows you as a user to go in there and use Carbon Black to help ferret out where that malware is, right? Huh. And once you think you've got it, we can then, you know, go basically have like a few different protection levels. We can start opening things up just a little bit to see what happens, to see if you get re-encrypted, you know? So we basically automate this whole process and allow you to get it, you know, to bring it back online live, but in a way that's very safe. So it's through the combination of our disaster recovery solution, VMware Cloud and AWS, as well as our Carbon Black endpoint security solution can create this thing. And the reason I brought up this ransomware recovery is that it's just such a top of mind issue for so many customers, both large and small, right? And this is one of those examples where, you know, it's very easy to get started with. And, you know, we really just take all of the guesswork out of it.
You said this is a completely automated process. Is that accurate?
It's mostly automated. There's still some manual aspects to it. Because what we try to do is help the user to figure out what they want to do. You know, which backup do they want to take? How do they validate that we found the malware and gotten it out of there? You know, these sorts of things, right?
So what you just said was like ridiculously cool. To think that you could have one computer, because, you know, you could roll back your machine instantly, then remove the machine from everyone else, and then have a thing kind of, like you just said, expand capabilities a little bit until it's identified and be like, I found it.
Yeah, slowly turn on network access and other things. Yeah, it's pretty, so like, you know, like you might say, hey, let's do internet traffic first. And if nothing goes haywire, then okay, maybe we start letting some east-west traffic in and seeing what happens there. Because sometimes what you find is that maybe there's some remote thing on the network that will activate the ransomware. And it's not coming from the internet, it's coming from some other impacted host or server within the network. So anyway, there's a whole bunch of these different things that we do. And yeah, I mean, the reality is a lot of people do this, they try to do it all manually, and it's such a headache, and you know, they keep getting re-encrypted. So yeah, so we're trying to simplify it.
That process you just described is actually like, it feels more like an epidemiology study. It's kind of cool.
It is. It's really, really interesting, actually, the sort of challenges that people have. And, you know, ransomware, as you know, is just a massive, massive problem. I mean, we're talking about, like, I don't know what the number is, like hundreds of billions of dollars here.
Yeah.
And growing every year. So,
and only the biggest cases now make the news. Like, I saw like ransomware of like a public utility, a municipality. And the ask was, I guess, a nominal fee. They paid it. I mean,
yeah. I think like I saw some public school system as well got hacked. And
yeah.
Yeah, it's not good. This is tough stuff, but, you know, we try to make it as simple as possible.
Yeah, this is super cool. You know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, since you are, you know, exceptionally knowledgeable on the subject, is there was for a while there was like a debate about what is, you know, the word edge is used a lot. What is the edge? You know what I mean? Yep. And some people are saying, well, you know, network speed's going to get so fast that you don't actually need to move compute to the edge because you can just move the data back to your compute, wherever that may be, and send it right back. It's going to improve. Then people are like, well, microservices are going to get so impressive that you can move those closer. So you don't need the big network to move it back. And then, of course, network requires the actual infrastructure to be there. We automatically know. We actually had a cool guest that was on talking about like the wind tunnels in Wyoming, which are about to power California. I don't know if you saw that. Like, California bought a line. But like in like the service techs in Wyoming, they had no way of like getting any type of cloud application to see like, let's say, diagrams and or how-to videos. Like they're in the middle of nowhere, right? And so we were talking about that. And like, so in your opinion, you know, the edge is like a loose term. What is going to happen? Is it going to be where we're going to just get so fast that you can have central compute? Is it always going to be compute's going to move closer to the location because you can't depend on network? Like where?
I think you'll see a little bit of everything. I mean, it's kind of like the old computer science answer. It depends, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of factors.
But
it's a term with no definition. What's
exactly? Like, but let's talk it through. I mean, so when I think about edge, the way I think about it is that we're really talking about any location that's not a data center or a cloud or a colo, right? Yeah. Now, typically what you find with edge locations is that IT personnel are not on premises there.
Yes.
And so what that means is that you've got to do sort of remote management. You got to automate a lot of things and so forth. You can't have someone running out there every time something goes wrong. I see a lot of different use cases around edge. I think that you look at a retail store, or anything like a factory where, you know, operational capabilities matter, and any sort of downtime can be hugely impactful to revenue, right? Now, again, there's ways of trying to get around that on the connectivity side. You know, again, SD-WAN comes into play there. You can have multiple connections and do sort of failover that way. But the other use case we see is actually just for some of these things, it's a latency issue that, you know, I know a number of factories where they have machines that are working and maybe building cars or doing whatever they're doing. And you have a whole bunch of telemetry looking at that machine. And you need a computer to be analyzing that telemetry and looking for any potential flaws or, you know, is it getting overheated or these other sorts of issues, and be able to very quickly take remediative actions to solve whatever problem it might be. So there, you know, you have a situation where latency actually and availability, of course, become top of mind. Sometimes it's just too costly that maybe you can have a remote connection, but there's just so much data. Like think about like video cameras, right? Mm-hmm. Like this giant amount of data, and you can analyze it. And, you know, the insights you get out of that analysis are usually pretty small in size. You're talking like less than 1% of the overall video feed data size. So these are all reasons why we think that, you know, edge will be here to stay, but it really depends on the use case. Now, I think where we as an industry are going with edge, and by the way, then there's a whole telco space, which I won't even get into because it's a little bit, their use cases are a little bit more unique than what we see generally across enterprises. But you know, when we think about edge, what we tend to think about it as is, how do you bring edge into the cloud era? And in some ways, what it would be nice is if you could programmatically reference an edge just like any other AZ. So if I want to put a workload, you know, in the cloud, I just, you know, say what AZ it wants to go to. And of course, the system there in the cloud will figure out, okay, which exact computer within that. But you could also imagine starting to manage edges as just another AZ, right? And so you can sort of programmatically refer to them. You can do workload placement there. You can do management. You can do some of these other things. So you're not going to have the elasticity of a cloud, but you're going to have some of the other capabilities that go along with it. So that's a lot of what we're really focused on, is how do you bring that sort of cloud capability and model really out to the edge?
I want to say, first of all, thank you for being here. You know, it's been fun. It's been fun hearing a lot of things that you guys are working on, thinking of how you're seeing the future of application development. And I was thinking about that term edge, right? Really what everyone wants to, when we're on the consumer side, I think about it for myself, is it's just a race to make things faster and more efficient. You know what I mean? Like that's what it is means for us as consumers. Like everyone's trying to figure out how to do bigger things closer to you so that whatever it is just operates faster. Like that's what it is on the consumer side. And so to us, we think to as a consumer, it's like, oh, it doesn't matter. Like what's going to move first. So I like the way you were approaching it, which is like, well, I guess, you know, unfortunately it really does depend. It's like whatever your application use case is, you got to use the tooling that gets that, makes that happen. The consumer doesn't actually know. Cause I remember there was a long debate, like what's going to actually happen. And the answer is always everything. Everything's going to happen. Like there is no one thing.
I mean, yeah. You look across, it's a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
So, and that's really how we're trying to design it as well. It's, I think one of the biggest values people are looking for is that sort of optionality and flexibility, but at the same time, not getting overwhelmed or mired in unnecessary complexity either. And that's kind of the tricky balance.
We've almost done with the hour, but I have to ask you this because you are the CTO of the company that's overseeing all this stuff. Uh-huh. So the amount of things you have to learn and get proficient at, possibly master, just keeps getting wider. There is no, like, that's also true too, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
You know, you're one of the few people we've talked to on the show ever that is, you know, started it as like just a I don't want to say entry level, but you know, you got,
that was an entry level,
entry level engineer. You're now the CTO.
That's exactly what
it was. Well, I don't want to, you know,
first job,
but you get my, like what is your philosophy on this continuous learning? Because yes, we all have continuous learning, but some of us kind of have capacity for things. Like we can only oversee so many things, and like the amount of things that you guys oversee at VMware and the technologies that you have to get really proficient at, if not master, just continues to increase and it's never going away. So
it does. You're right. And it's a challenge. I mean, I saw a couple of things, right? For me personally, in my role now, like I don't have as much time to really dig into like the details of all the tech. Like I know things kind of at a high level and, and have some sense about how the products work and can explain it to some degree. But this is a big problem that we see with a lot of customers. Like one of the biggest challenges that we see is actually their inability to hire the right sort of expertise. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is where, you know, when we start looking at what we're talking about with multi-cloud and cross-cloud services. You know, today what you need is you need, you know, if you've got multiple clouds, you need an on-prem team, you need an AWS team, you need an Azure team, you need a Google team. So basically you need a team for each of these different environments. And that will probably always be the case. But the question is, can we take a lot of those people who are spread out across many of the teams and use them to work on these cross-cloud services, these sort of common sets of capabilities that can hopefully reduce, you know, the overall need across the company. And then at an individual level, you know, I do think it's all about continuous learning and, you know, sort of pushing yourself, right? And there's, you know, some obvious things like, you know, we see a lot happening around Kubernetes in the cloud native space. Now, you know, I think it's an absolute imperative to learn how, you know, machine learning, large language models, et cetera, work and some of the tooling, you know, open source tools like Ray and so forth. There's a bunch of these things out there. Personally, I see like the industry being at another large inflection point with the rise of large language models and just machine learning more generally. And I think it's going to be a foundational change to how we do almost everything, how we develop code, how we, you know, produce marketing material, like, you know, all sorts of stuff, like write documents. So this is really going to be foundational. So this is, you know, as we talked about, the pace is pretty wild and pretty fast, but you got to set aside time for that learning. And I think that's something I try to do. Of course, a bit in a microcosm because I don't go nearly as deep as, you know, the technical experts. But that's also the fun part about it, though. You know, it's like fun to learn this new stuff and to play with and kind of geek out with the cool new stuff.
All right. So I got one final question for you before our time's up. You know, you've covered so much. It's great hearing the way you and your team are thinking about modern application development. And like we said, it's not going to go away. So if you had advice for, let's say there's a CTO, CIO listening to this show, they're at a couple hundred employees and they're about to expand multi-location, hybrid. They got to go wider availability zones. They're starting to land enterprise customers that are pushing them further ahead.
Yep.
How would you recommend they get their answers? Because they all have questions, right? Like, so it doesn't matter what the question is. Where should they go? Who's the trusted resource? Or where would you go to say, hey, this is where you would go to learn? Because you mentioned before that like you're always on a continuous learning path. So where should be my first or second place I go to get that resource? Because if you just Google stuff, who knows where you'll go?
Yeah. I mean, ChatGPT can provide a lot of answers, I think.
Oh, dang.
Now, look, I mean, I think it really depends on, you know, what you're trying to do. So if I'm talking to someone in that position, you know, they're likely what they do is they have a small, what we call a platform team. This is a team that provides a lot of these sort of common services and the plumbing that supports the product teams. And that'd be a big focus for me because like getting that platform team properly set up so that they are focused on the sort of cross cloud architecture so that, you know, they can support additional clouds when and if necessary. That sort of initial investment right now will actually pay off dividends in the years to come, right? So it's really about how do you get that sort of posture such that you're ready for these, you know, whatever might come your way.
There you go. That is the advice of the day. If you're out there listening, get yourself a platform team that Kit's talking about and start doing a lot of homework. It will pay itself off in the future. Kit, I want to say thanks again for joining us today on IT Visionaries. It was great having you. I'm sure our millions of listeners will be tuning in. And, you know, I age myself again. All right, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Tuning in.
Like, all good.
I said dial in once and when someone looked at me like, what are you talking about? What does dialing in mean? He asked me.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know. What does that even mean anymore?
I don't know. Thanks again for joining us today on IT Visionaries.
All right. Thanks for having me. It was fun as always.